Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, my name is Seb Inglis-Jones, and I am the co-founder and co-CEO of Maving. We are Britain's first electric motorcycle manufacturer, and we are based in Coventry and make all our bikes here in the UK.
The Driven Chat podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's Driven Chat podcast, the penultimate episode of this podcast. More on that in a bit. If you're hearing that message for the first time, don't panic. It's not the end. There's more coming. But I'm saying hello, and as you've just heard there, we are this week talking to Seb Inglis-Jones, who is the co-founder of Maving, an electric motorcycle company. And I'm delighted, Seb, because on the very rare occasion we're recording a podcast where I've had to travel a very small distance. Our office is just on the other side of that dual carriageway out of this window. And thanks for being so local.
That's a pleasure. So do you have the pleasure of looking at us literally across the carriageway? Can you see the name?
Not quite that close, no. But our office was next to your previous outfit. So we have seen on the road many times Mavings being ridden around, I'm guessing, on final tests or sign-offs or some sort of exciting process.
And that, yes, or not so exciting process. We have some amazing people whose job it is to put just, you know, hundreds of miles on the bikes per day just to build up our data sets, and they are incredibly patient. Whatever the weather, they're out there riding around. So it Brilliant. Might just be that.
Excellent. It's worth pointing out as well, despite being so local, we're here recording this episode on a day where you have quite literally just moved in, haven't you? This is quite exciting. So you'll notice, dear listener, that we might have a bit of an echo in this room. That's because we're in an office which I'd imagine in a matter of days is going to be flourished with all sorts of motorcycle paraphernalia and great sound-absorbing objects. But until then, it is a bit of a blank, empty space. But you've just given me a bit of a whistle-stop tour of your brand new facility, which is amazing. So tell us, what's prompted the move?
Yeah, it's really exciting. Well, first of all, you're totally right. I mean, 2 hours ago, I was having minor bickers with my co-founder about where we were going to put our freshly built desks in our new office. So it really is. It's day one of the move, and this is essentially just we've been bursting at the seams at our previous unit where we built up our production capacity to make about 5 bikes a day. But really, that was as much as we could manage. And we had, you know, components as I say, bursting at the seams and stock sitting in different locations. It was becoming a bit unwieldy, even though it already seemed like a pretty big space to me, given that we, you know, it wasn't that long ago that I was working with my co-founder in our living room in a little flat in London. But yeah, this factory is the kind of is our home for the foreseeable future, and it's just significantly increasing our production capacity when we look at our international growth.
Brilliant stuff. Well, we'll get into the details of what this factory and this space is going to be used for soon, no doubt. But before we get there, one of the things I like to do, as you may have heard, I know you've listened to one or two of these episodes before, is we like to build up a picture of you and find out where this world might have started. So can you tell me, Seb, a very early core memory, something perhaps as a small child or perhaps even a young adult, an occasion or a memory or something that might have switched on the pilot light that's ultimately got you to the seat you're sat in right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've always been into cars and bikes, but never I would have loved to have had a parent who was a sort of mechanic and to have learned how to actually build and, you know, take things apart. And I'm very ashamed to say that even now, being in the industry, I still have to ask other people to do things for me. I'm terrible when it comes to maintenance. So I've never been a tinkerer, but I love driving, love riding, love looking at, you know, cars and bikes. And I was thinking, what was the first thing that got me excited about cars and bikes? And it was when I had, I think my parents had round for dinner a friend who, generally speaking, my parents, I think all their friends had like old Volvos and you know, little Vauxhall Astras. And suddenly there was this gentleman who came around for dinner, and he had a brand new, I think it was a Jag, it was a an XK. Uh-huh. And my mum sort of knew that I was vaguely into cars. I must have been like 7 years old, yeah, or something like that. And the guy offered to take me for a drive in his car, and he this is in Clapham, tiny streets, and he took me, you know, on a rally circuit essentially around Clapham. I was strapped in the front. I'd never experienced anything like this, and I was thrilled, absolutely loved it, fell in love with that car. I mean, I'm not convinced it's a beautiful car now, but I just that first kind of exhilaration of being in a car and enjoying it. And I'm definitely not a sort of thrill seeker at all, but it's one of the few arenas in which I feel very comfortable and kind of unfazed. It's behind the wheel of a car, much to the dismay of my mates and the 9 points that I've got on my license at the moment. But so yeah, just, you know, from that moment was absolutely hooked on driving cars, and then I think since then fell in love with all sorts of kind of classic cars and bikes. I think it was when I saw Gone in 60 Seconds, became fascinated, as I think everyone was in that era, with the 1967 Shelby GT500.
Yep.
And actually, I remember it wasn't that long ago, I passed a dealer in Shepherd's Bush, and they had a black one with a red racing stripe down it. And I was actually at the time about to place a deposit on my first little flat, and I genuinely thought maybe there's a world in which I just buy this car and I run away. That was it.
Start using the man maths and going, well, I saw a headline that property prices may be dropping, so now
maybe it's
a better time to buy the car first, run that for a year, and then get the property.
Exactly, it's only going to go up. You know, this is a classic. There's you know, probably 2,000 in the world. You know, it's a sensible investment. You know, before you obviously wrap it around a tree. But I just that car was actually the first car that really got me. I think James May says fizzing. But and then in terms of bikes, I think it was when I was 19, I was traveling around the world as a lowly surf instructor, and I spent a bit of time in Thailand, and that was the first time I think I presumably lied about having a license and rented a you know, 250 scrambler and experienced a bike. Great. For the first time. And then actually subsequently spent, you know, months sort of riding around Indonesia. I spent 3 months on a surf trip with my co-founder riding around Indonesia. So that was my first, and that wasn't on a glamorous bike. You know, these are on little 125cc geared bikes that have been maintained for years. But that gave me the riding bug.
Brilliant stuff. I do love hearing the stories where you kind of get that moment, or you hear about that moment where somebody says, or maybe even just thinks at the time, oh, I get it now. Because you do. You have people that have that vague interest in cars or motorbikes. And yeah, for me, I was a late bloomer to motorbikes. I was driving 11 years before I'd even considered doing a CBT. And I remember doing my CBT, riding around on a motorbike for a bit and going, oh, I'm not really sure about this. But then one day something just clicked and I went, oh, I get it. I see why this is such a big thing. And it's always great hearing those stories from other people as well.
Definitely. It's worth saying, actually, that I also was a late bloomer on bikes because it was the one thing that my mum made me promise that I should never... I think that's a pretty common experience. And so clearly I felt that I had to start a motorcycle company in order to get around that loophole. But I was also a kind of late bloomer on bikes.
I do think it is the best way to learn, though. I remember getting some fabulous advice probably about the time that I was getting my car license. I would have been about 17 or 18. And there was a family friend who did ride motorcycles. And he said, you have to promise me one thing, that you won't try and learn the road on a motorbike. Learn it in a car first.
Totally agree.
Bikes come later. And it is the single best bit of advice I think anyone's ever offered me in terms of driving on the road, because it all makes sense. I know that there are people that go out there and jump on the bike first thing and learn that bit first. But yeah, there is a better way.
I totally agree. But also just from a kind of... being a bit more mature, you know, the first thing I did when I got my driving license at the age of 17 was to hop in the Nissan Micra that I had at my disposal and to try and see if I could do a handbrake turn round round a bend in Somerset where my parents are based. And obviously that is not a car. It's a front wheel drive Nissan Micra. It's not designed to drift round corners. And luckily the verge that I ended up on pretty quickly was soft, but you don't want to be in that kind of headspace if you're getting on a bike for the first time. I think it's better to learn those, you know, or sort of gently front end someone in a car before you gently front end someone on a bike, which is not, you know, it's not the right thing to do. But I guess because of that, I've never had an accident riding, and I guess you just do drive, ride more defensively.
Absolutely. Yeah, very, very true. So talk to me about Maving then. And afterwards, I'm going to pick your brains on how it all started. But in a summary, let's say, obviously, I know about the product. I have a Maving sat at home right now, thanks to Potsky Media, who sorted that one out for me. So I've got a bike. I've got the little R1M sat outside my house.
RM1.
RM1. So,
which stands for removable battery one, incidentally. Very simply.
I didn't know that. Well, that's now I can never forget it. So I've got one sat at home, which is really cool, really exciting. It looks fantastic. So I've got a bit of an advantage, I guess, in knowing what the product is and what it's all about. But let's imagine you're meeting somebody for the first time, says, right, who are you, what do you do, and what is Maving? How do you answer that question?
Yeah, so, look, we're Britain's first electric motorcycle manufacturer, and I'm proud to say currently the best selling, which it's a pretty nascent market, so you're dealing with a relatively small kind of set there. But we basically hand-build electric motorbikes in Coventry. And the thing that sets them aside, I guess, from maybe conventional EVs and from other bikes in the market is that they have removable batteries that you can take out and charge at a standard socket. Mm-hmm. And the whole sort of point of that is that the number one barrier to EV adoption is charging infrastructure and the kind of inconvenience of charging. The reality is that, you know, 80% of the people in this country live in cities or urban areas. Mm-hmm. The average commute is about 6.7 miles. You know, most journeys you're doing in a town or a city in a relatively short distance on your own. Mm-hmm. And so you actually, first of all, you don't need a big SUV or an electric SUV.
Yeah.
So we're big kind of, I guess, evangelists for the idea that two wheels is a good solution, just generally, and that much like Southern Europe and parts of Asia, you know, more people should choose two wheels as their number one form of transport. Appreciate we've got some bad weather here, but we're an optimistic nation. I think we have more convertibles here than any other.
That's true.
Per capita, don't we?
Yeah, that's true.
So given all of that, you can actually have a kind of battery that is small enough that you can take it out and charge it in a standard socket. So you'd use your bike throughout the week, and then you get to maybe a Friday, take the battery out and you charge them overnight. Just sort of as you would do a phone.
Absolutely.
Or at your office or at a cafe. And it's just a kind of completely different way of looking at the whole EV space, really.
Fabulous. The great observation that a few mates of mine have had, have popped round and seen it, is a bit like a power tool. You take the battery off your drill or your saw, whatever you're using, you put that power pack or the battery into a little power pack charger. Once it's charged, it goes back into the tool and off you go.
Exactly.
And to me, it seems to make so much sense. And I think a lot of people, let's say the EV skeptics out there who are saying, oh, you know, it's not going to work, and if the battery dies, we're going to have to take the car apart, and that's going to cost £70,000 or more. Arguments which, you know, some of them aren't quite factually correct, but I understand why people feel the way that they do. So to finally see a product where the battery is removable and easily removable, because it's the click of a button, something opens up and it slides out just like it would do on a power pack on a drill, click it into your charging point, it makes so much sense. So why do you think other people aren't doing it like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So first of all, I'd say that I'm really, look, as we've just been talking about, I've grown up a petrol head. I love petrol bikes, love petrol cars. And I'm a kind of firm believer that you're only going to get people switching when you've made something which is genuinely better, competitive. It makes sense versus its internal combustion engine counterpart. And so I do not begrudge a lot, the millions of people out there who go, no, I need to do 500 miles in my van, or I need to do X, Y, and Z, and I can't, there's not an electric alternative, or I won't pay the 30% whatever it might be.
Sure.
And I think, one of the reasons why, certainly in the motorbike space or the kind of two wheel space, people haven't been doing that is because the example that's been given to us is plug-in vehicles, and also the simple fact of the matter is that it's very hard to make a full power electric motorbike at the moment or scooter that is competitive with or can replace at this moment in time a full power petrol touring bike, for example. With a car, you can just put loads more batteries in it. And it doesn't matter that it weighs 2.5 tons because it goes 0-60 in 3 seconds.
Yeah.
On a bike, you can't do that. If you can't put 300 kilos worth of batteries in, people will fall over. It's not safe. So you're dealing with a sort of space claim, which is just different from that of a car. And so the companies, dare I say it, that have kind of tried to make plug-in bikes, which are expensive, maybe can only do 60 or 80 miles and then need to be plugged in for an hour, whatever it might be, you can understand why people are not adopting those bikes.
Absolutely, yeah.
However, in the kind of low power CBT 125cc category, where you are, you're riding across London, 5-10 miles or whatever, Manchester, whatever it might be, there is a very good reason to go electric, because if you use removable batteries, you only have to cover those distances. I mean, bear in mind that our bikes can go 70 miles per hour and cover 80 miles of range. So you can very much do a week's worth of commuting, and then you just take the battery out and it costs you like 70p to charge.
Yeah.
And so, I guess it doesn't seem duplicitous to me that you might have a kind of petrol car or van or whatever it might be for long distances or for carrying greater loads, but at the same time appreciate that you could do 95% of your journeys on a little electric, e-bike or scooter or motor, whatever it might be. So I think in the first instance it's about understanding where electric makes sense and is genuinely competitive and compelling. And then ultimately, us all, I suppose, slowly adopting it because it is the future, and it is, there's obviously, the reason we started this business is because of its effect on the planet. But I would never try and tell, all my fellow motorcyclists out there that they should replace their GS, 1200 GS or something like that. It's just not, that there isn't an electric motorbike out there that's comparable.
Yeah.
But in this sphere, it's compelling.
Absolutely. So let's talk about then the early stages of the company and the trigger point to getting it all started, really. What was it that made even the idea of building a small electric motorcycle a thing?
Yeah, well, it's worth saying that despite what I was saying about always being into cars and bikes, which is true for me, by the way, not so much for my co-founder. He's a recent convert and is now becoming an expert. But it's actually quite good because he's coming at it from the kind of consumer who's never been into bikes.
Absolutely, yeah.
But we met at uni and we decided sort of pretty early on that we wanted to start a company together. I can sort of go into our compatibility a little bit later. But and so for us in the first instance, it was about how do we combat climate change, because that was what we thought. This is the biggest challenge, I guess, of our generation. And if you're going to devote your whole life you know, working late hours in an office, starting a business, which is stressful, to say the least, then, you know, it's helpful to know that you're doing it for you know, for the right reasons. And so we you know, the plan was right. We'll leave uni. We'll go into our respective careers. We'll build up a bit of a CV. We, you know, build up some expertise. Him in finance, me in marketing, because that's just our sort of natural skill set. And then we'll kind of we'll quit in 5 years' time, let's say, and we'll start a business and we'll find out what it's going to be.
So that, at this point, you haven't got an actual vision of what that business might be. Just a business.
A business.
Wow.
Climate change. That was it. That was the blank slate. And then when the time came to quit, which we did, and we went through this whole period where we kind of did little odd jobs to sort of, you know, keep ourselves alive and kind of look for what it was that we wanted to do. And I guess if you don't have an engineering bone in your body, and you're not a physicist, you're not a chemist, whatever it might be, you're not in a position to solve, you know, the big, really challenging technical problems of things like carbon sequestering and concrete production, or, you know, whatever it might be. Conversely, the world of transport and electrification is you know, it's been talked about for quite some time. It's quite well mapped. The idea of electrifying transport, decarbonizing the grid, is kind of, you know, we can, people like you and I can wrap our heads around it. And so it was quite natural to look in the transport space. Obviously, you've got, you know, companies like Tesla and Rivian out there who are kind of those sort of unicorns that set a bit of a vision. But what we didn't expect when we were looking at that space was that the country with the highest rate of EV adoption was China, and it was in a two-wheel space where 80% of riders were riding on electric.
Wow, 80?
Yeah, and everyone was talking about, I think it was Norway at that moment. You know, Norway, I think, had just passed 50% electric new sales, and it's in the car world, and everyone was going, wow, that's, you know, that's incredible. And suddenly here was this, you know, whopping great country that people weren't talking about, who had already clearly undergone some sort of revolution. We were sort of fascinated by that, and when we looked into what it was all lightweight scooters with removable batteries. As is sometimes the case in China, they change rules somewhat overnight, and industries have to adapt pretty quickly. And basically over about 7 years, that, you know, they'd outlawed to more or less an extent petrol vehicles in cities because of the air pollution in, you know, cities like Beijing and Shanghai. And so what people had basically done was they'd taken their Honda Cubs or whatever, and they'd hooked up little lead acid car batteries. And sort of 7 years later, they developed an entire industry of you know, bikes and scooters with removable batteries, and had basically leapfrogged this whole infrastructure, charging infrastructure challenge that is basically the center of the debate in the West. You know, it's all about how many fast chargers can we put on motorways, and it's that kind of thing. So you go over to, I don't know how much time you've spent in cities like Shanghai, but you go there and it's just millions of people riding around on these silent, you know, electric scooters. Just, you know, the lights go green and they all just take off and it's peaceful. And it's so that was the kind of inspiration for the business. And originally we thought, okay, well, you know, we'll just import a bike from China. And sort of long story short, the reality of all the products out there is that they're built to a much lower price ceiling.
Got it.
And they have a different set of concerns around quality, basically. The longevity of the products and to some extent the kind of heritage is not front and center. And so even the best products out there just aren't really going to satisfy your European customer and, you know, people here in the UK. And then conversely, in this country, we have a huge storied history of motorcycle design. And it's one of the kind of few areas of industry that we're genuinely renowned for, you know, globally. So eventually we thought, right, we'll do it ourselves. We'll start an automotive company from scratch. We will get the best engineers that we can find in the country, and we'll build the bikes here. That was the beginning.
Wow. That must have been fairly daunting, I guess, especially reflecting on that heritage that you're right, we have. You know, you think BSA, you think Royal Enfield, you think Triumph, Norton, Triton. There are just so many brands that the global motorcycling world think of when they think of Britain or England. And so to then come along and say, right, let's tap into this market, but as a brand new company, a new logo, a new badge that perhaps people haven't seen, was that terrifying? Or did you kind of think, no, do you know what? I think we could be onto something as it's a bit different.
Look, I think all entrepreneurs probably need like a combination of complete determination and optimism, but also blissful ignorance.
Yeah.
I think if anyone was to appreciate actually quite how challenging it was to do, you know, whatever business, particularly hardware, that they're going to start, they might not do it in the first instance. So no, but I guess it's kind of one step in front of the other.
Yeah.
So, you know, we sort of came back from having invested about a year in China and think, you know, the sort of first iteration of the business, and we were slightly tail between legs because that hadn't worked out. We thought all that work was at the spout, but then we went through this kind of process where we spoke to a friend of ours who is a engineer. We kind of drew out on a big piece of, you know, parchment paper roughly what the process would be to building a prototype, getting investment, and I guess well, to you, it obviously might look like a building site right now, but you know, I look around this much bigger factory now, and I go, yeah, "This is flipping exciting!" And look at this amazing team. But obviously, in the first instance, it was just, you know, me and my co-founder, and then it was us and five engineers, and then it was and every step was, you can sort of imagine how we got there.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, as I said, there've been some absolutely horrendous. Look, we begun our fundraiser a month before COVID.
Oh, wow.
We then basically negotiated all of our supplier terms in the midst of the supply crisis. We launched our first product just as, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine.
Yeah.
And then the whole period that we've been selling bikes has been in the midst of a kind of cost of living crisis and a global recession. So the timing has been tricky. And, you know, there are some horror stories of bits, you know, parts getting stuck in various parts of the world, yeah, and all that. But
if you're a spiritual person that perhaps relied on signs, maybe you'd think, perhaps this isn't the time.
Again, I think that's the dogged determination of the entrepreneur, misguided optimism. Yeah, no, I'm certainly really kind of proud of the progress when I look back on it now. But I was also proud when we were standing in a much smaller shed, and I was telling our head of production that he needed to build a log cabin as a meeting room, because it was $4,000 versus a $15,000 prefab meeting room, you know. So yeah. Even in the first instance, when it was just a small team and we were building our first, you know, pre-production prototypes, it felt like a huge step from me and Will working in the living room of our flat in council building an elephant and castle.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Love that. So then talk to me about some of the major chapters, because obviously the space that we're in now is substantial. This is was it a storage facility, or did they do some work here on bikes as well?
This was a dealer. A dealer distributor, right. Yeah. So they had, yeah, that was actually why we picked it out, was because it was sort of all already mapped out nicely in terms of stores and production and kind of, you know, what was their workshop is now our pre-delivery inspection area and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's almost, I mean, location as well. What are the chances that you've managed to find a second location essentially over the road? If you were good at golf, you could probably hit a golf ball from one site to the other. But you found this perfectly motorcycle-friendly facility where, so I'm guessing here, you're going to do absolutely everything from bringing in parts for the builds to the physical builds themselves to the distribution,
exactly.
Everything in-house.
Yes, yeah, no, exactly, precisely. So you know, as I was saying, if you come back in sort of a couple of months, you'll have a long production line,
right.
Building our old and new model, everything here. And again, because we're direct to consumer, the vans that are parked outside will be taking bikes to customers around the country. And there's also that big trailer as well out front, which will take our bikes, our European bikes, across the border.
Excellent.
So it's really lovely. We had he was a 93-year-old gentleman who got in touch with us. He used to be a test rider for Francis Barnett, for one of the old British marques.
Yeah.
And he said, please, I love the design of your bikes. I'd love to just come and see your factory, which is based a kind of stone's throw from where I used to be. Can we do this? And he also wanted to ride a bike as well, which is quite fun. I think he hadn't ridden for 17 years, but we managed to make it happen. Cool. But he came in and he said, "Oh wow, this feels familiar. You know, this feels a lot." And he showed me this scrapbook with photos from, you know, production lines of the kind of 60s, 70s,
right.
Or 50. I can't remember when it was that Francis Barnett came to an end. But and it is it's pretty similar. You know, I mean, it's pretty familiar. You've got bikes rolling along a production line, being built, you know, assembled here by our you know, relatively small team. Meanwhile, our engineers sitting upstairs working on the next bikes, and you know, it's very there's a certain charm to it, I think. Yeah. If you think of, you know, the giant Nissan factory and you've got machines, you know, piecing everything together, it's very much not that.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah. In a town which is renowned for exactly this, isn't it? You know, Coventry is a city that has been at the forefront of automotive construction since the birth of the car, really. You know, you've got Alvis, the Alvis factory was just down the road from here. You've got Jaguar Land Rover down the road from here. You've just got so many engineering companies and gearing companies. It seems to be a real hub in the centre of the country.
Completely. And look, it's no secret. I mean, we moved here quite simply because we regard Triumph as the best example of, you know, British motorcycle design and production, and we wanted to get the best engineers. So our head of product was Triumph's head of product, a guy called Graham Gilbert. He's exceptionally talented, and it just is the place to be, you know, for motorcycle engineering and a lot of other automotive engineering projects. But I think it's telling that, you know, we were talking about Ola a second ago. Mm. Ola, you know, this is a India's the biggest bike market. You know, it's huge, and the numbers over there versus. So it's worth saying when we started this business, there was 297 or 93 electric motorbikes and scooters sold in total in this country. Same year in China, it was over 20 million.
Oh wow!
And India is now India's already the biggest bike market, but it's now got the biggest growing, you know, fastest growing EV scene. And Ola is an example of that. You know, it's been around for a few years. They're already, you know, in the sort of position where they're selling 50,000, you know, their new scooter in the first week and that kind of thing. But their sort of design headquarters are here. They're down the road.
Yeah.
And they clearly value the expertise, you know, that's around here. And I think if you're driving around Coventry, you might not think it's the most beautiful place in the world. You might not be thinking here's, you know, there's a sort of rich history here in the way that, I don't know, I haven't been to Detroit, but I imagine it's a bit more obvious that it's one of the great car building centres. But lo and behold, tucked away in all these units around here, there's extraordinary expertise.
It is a remarkable thing, and it's something a lot of our international listeners, some of whom are actually quite aware of it, think Formula One, you know, the forefront of motorsport in the world is the one that everyone knows. Whether you're a car person or not, you know what a Formula One car is, and the vast majority of them, again, are within about 40 or 50 miles from here. All the teams, the cars are built here, engineered here, tested here, and then go off to represent brands from all over the world.
It's 100%. Incredible. And the only difference is that from the outside, they look like, you know, sheds and concrete, whereas in other parts of the world, they're sort of beautiful design facilities. But on the inside, you've got, not just all that expertise, but actually amazing facilities as well for testing. I mean, you know, when we arrived here, the amount of support that we've had from whether it's the local government with loans, or whether it's people saying we can use their testing facilities or their tracks, you know, whatever it might be, there's a lot of stuff here that is incredibly helpful to someone trying to navigate the world of starting an EV company for the first time.
So, brilliant. Yeah. Let's cut to a really quick advert break, and then when we come back, I want to explore the models that you've got, so the existing model, the one that's coming next, and get a bit of a bigger vision about where this company may be heading. We shall be right back.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites.
So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Driven Chat Podcast.
And we are back. John Markar here with Seb in the brand new one day old headquarters of Maving Motorcycles, which is really, really exciting. So, Seb, you've done a fantastic job of building up a picture of you and how this all started. So I guess we should probably start talking about what the factory is actually putting out onto the road, what the reception has been like from customers and from buyers, despite launching in perhaps, I'm sure we will look back on this period of time as being one of the most difficult times to A, launch a company, let alone try and sell anything. Because we are, as you quite rightly said, in a cost of living crisis that's affecting just about everyone in the world. So at the point of getting the first product ready, once you'd decided, right, this is what our bike's going to look like, this is how it's going to work, it's going to have removable batteries, how did the public react and how did you go about getting that product from the ideas board to rolling into people's homes?
Sure. Well, look, the first thing I'd say is because the sorts of British bikes that are really popular and we're sort of renowned for are those kind of cafe race, you know, the 60s, 70s, the James Dean, Steve McQueen kind of thing. It was really important to us that we brought that kind of heritage with us into our design, not in a kind of stuffy resto mod way necessarily, but just the kind of the you know, the naked shout, that we didn't have sort of lots of extraneous plastic, that everything was really pleasing to touch, you know, lots of exposed metalwork, that kind of thing. And I think that was because a bit of an antidote to that trend in electric at the moment, which is making vehicles which are overly futuristic. And maybe in the process, and I get it, you know, to differentiate them from the petrol models.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a risk that in doing that you lose a little bit of the heart and soul. You know, for example, having a whopping great LCD screen. You know, we work quite hard to convert the analog signal into the digital one into an analog, so that we can have a nice old simple speedo.
Yeah.
You know, it tells you everything you need to know, but nothing you don't. And as I said, that was a kind of antidote to the really futuristic models that were being thrown on the market, and also to the more kind of plasticky scooters. So we wanted to retain that kind of British heritage style, make the bikes really pleasing to touch, really focus on quality. That was a big point for us. I've lost my train of thought. Where was I? Okay. So we kind of drew up this. I did some pretty rudimentary concept sketches in the first instance, looking at different kind of eras of motor. Mm-hmm. So we also looked at the kind of 20s, 30s, the board tracker era, where the first British bikes were basically being productionized from bicycles. So they were quite simple, slender frames with these very small engine blocks and very kind of elegant.
Yeah.
And again, predominantly used for urban riding. Mm-hmm. So I drew out all of these kind of bikes, and we sort of fixated on a few different styles that we put into a brief. Will basically pulled together a powertrain, you know, clued himself up on motors and battery packs, got a sense as to the sort of power spec that we needed. Took that to went through a bit of a tendering process with design consultancies and eventually built the first prototype, which we used for funding. But then brought on the team and you know, productionized the piece. It's worth saying that design to people like me usually means kind of the what you see, you know, the A surface, the outside. 99% of the design is everything that goes on inside.
Absolutely.
And our incredibly experienced engineering team, we've got a guy on the team who's been designing motorbikes for 43 years.
Wow.
They are responsible for all the nooks and crannies and all the mechanisms and you know, everything that actually makes the bike work and ride well.
Right.
But yeah.
So at the point that you've got your first product, the bike that resembles what's going to be going up for sale, what people are going to be putting deposits down, the bike that people might be seeing at shows, what was that first reaction like?
So it was very positive. And I think when we stood back and we saw the first kind of production bike, I think we felt that we made something that was beautiful, and we felt intuitively that there would be people out there who would just love it and would want it because of its looks.
Yeah.
But I think we felt when we launched it at Motorcycle Live, the biggest UK motorcycle show, that actually there might be a bit of hostility from the motorcycle fraternity. And it is a fraternity, you know, it's 90% male. Because these are people who are, more than the car world, passionate about bikes. They're real hobbyists. They are, you know, these are people who are a lot more engaged with the sector than the average car buyer is the car.
Yeah.
And we thought, they're going to hate us. We're electric. We're new. As I was saying earlier, you know, there are good reasons why you might be a bit disappointed with the kind of full-size electric bikes at the moment and not want to switch. But do you know what? We were actually... it was received really well. And I think that was in part down to the design, to the fact that we were sort of representing this British heritage design, and that it was actually built here. I think that was really important. I think there was a kind of shared sense of pride that we were one of the first European manufacturers in the space,
absolutely,
and that they were all actually being built here. You know, there was a sort of eyebrows raised then when they realised that we were, you know, this is a show that's in Birmingham, and they realised these were built just down the road, and that the team were, you know, former Triumph engineers or from companies that they recognised. I think that was hugely helpful for us. Also, the fact that we weren't trying to replace their big bikes, we were saying, look, this is a kind of cool addition to your existing fleet, as it were.
Yeah, which is a normal thing, isn't it? I think that's another comparison between car owners and car passionate people, the difference with bikes, because they are a bit more attainable. They are,
You know,
in most cases, a quarter the price of what you might be spending on an equivalent desirable car. So a lot of bikers have two or three bikes. So the idea that this might be another bike in their collection seemed to make perfect sense.
Yeah, bikers are a lot more, you know, they have a touring bike, and they've got a kind of street bike, and they've got a 90s sports bike for whizzing around on the weekends. It's a little bit more segmented in that sense, as opposed to having a car that takes you A to B, and, you know, if you like driving a bit, you want it to be a bit more powerful than a Vauxhall Astra. But so I think the idea that we were going, look, we're not asking you to ditch all of that. We're just suggesting that here is now a city runaround that is going to be easier to maintain, more affordable to use, and, you know, you're doing the planet a bit of good in the process. So I think that sort of sell was compatible with the existing passion and kind of sentiment in the room. So I think we were surprised to find that we were well received, and to this day, touch wood, we've all the reviews that we've had have been really, really positive. You know, as far as I can see, I'm very happy for someone to challenge me on this, but I think we are the best reviewed electric motorbike in the world. I haven't seen a better bike review. I think the only bike that comes close is the former Harley Davidson Livewire, but that's a, you know, $30,000 bike.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think we've made something that really works for the arena in which it's been designed.
Absolutely. So yeah, let's talk about that first product then, because you set out not to take on the big power bikes, not to try and reinvent the wheel in the sense of, right, let's try and make a big fast electric bike, because some companies have there are plenty of manufacturers out there that have gone for the electric sports bike look, and it's not quite perhaps sold in the way that I think a lot of these companies were hoping it would, for various reasons. As you alluded to earlier on in our conversation, the fact that to make them fast and have a long range, it needs a big battery, therefore it's heavy. That's immediately counterbalancing what a sports bike should be. And then, of course, comes down to the charging times, having to find somewhere to plug the thing in. If you're going out riding with your mates and you're all on 1,000cc superbikes and you're the one on the electric bike, they're going to take 5 minutes to fill their tanks whilst you're going, right, I'll catch you up when this is done in 8 hours. You know, it doesn't really work. But with what you set out to achieve, that was never going to be an issue, because, of course, you're making a commuter bike, essentially, something that's relatively low power, relatively low speed. If you're living in a city or a town and you're commuting a short distance every day, it seems to just work perfectly. So at what point... Well, let's talk about the first bike first, actually, because that is the important one. What were your goals to achieve with that? Was it to, as you say at the beginning, try to steer people away from the little twist-and-go petrol scooters, or was there more to it than that?
So I think it was to, as you said, unashamedly make a bike that was designed for urban travel and to be the kind of best at that.
Yeah.
So you're a rider. You're probably know what it's like trying to duck and weave with a GS.
Yeah,
I was talking about absolutely. That earlier. It's not ideal. You know, there's a very good case for scooters and 125cc, 250cc bikes mm-hmm. in town, you know, with relatively low saddles, so you can put your feet on the ground. You know, all of that stuff makes it easier to maneuver yourself in cities that have relatively high kind of congestion. So we're always going to make a bike that was small and it was going to be light and that was going to help with the range and so on and so forth. We also specifically wanted to inspire people who actually have never thought about owning a motorcycle or scooter at all to enter the category, i.e. to not necessarily be a bike that is designed to convert existing ardent petrol head riders who, you know, will live and die on a petrol bike, but actually to show a lot of, let's say, young urban commuters who, you know, might be fed up with being sort of stuck on the tube in London, might be fed up with paying, I don't know, £200 a month for their Oyster card, and are maybe looking at e-bikes or maybe looking at just alternative forms of transport, that there is actually an electric vehicle mm-hmm. for them, which might serve as an entry point to the two-wheeled space. So there's about 115,000 new motorbikes and scooters sold in this country every year, but there's probably, and I'm plucking this number out of thin air, 500,000 people in London alone or Manchester alone whose lives would be benefited from having a form of two-wheel transport that can get them across that city in 20 minutes, ostensibly. So for us, it's really about bringing more and more people into the two-wheel category. Mm-hmm. And as I said, trying to show people what is well known in Southern Europe and Asia, which is that actually scooters and bikes can be the most sensible form of transport. They are fun to ride. They are affordable. As I said, it's like 70p a week for your commuting versus a couple hundred quid. Our bikes are like 90 quid on finance. A month. That they are reliably fast because you're not stuck in traffic, and they're obviously clean. You know, it's probably relatively easy to understand that it's a lot better for the planet to make a small vehicle than a big vehicle. So it's always going to be better to make a little electric motorbike than it is a big SUV, SUV. But right down to the kind of emissions per mile per capita, it's just, we got a third party study done and it's less, our bikes emit less carbon per capita per mile than even the London Underground.
Wow.
So there's lots of good reasons to get people onto two-wheel transport. That was a long-winded answer to your question. But I think for us, the big mission is about trying to give people an opportunity to trial two wheels.
Absolutely. And it's worth mentioning as well that the bikes are rideable with a CBT, which is the entry-level license, isn't it? You can go pay whatever it is now, £80-90 for the day or two course, stick some L plates on, that's yours to ride then. Simple as that.
Absolutely. And twist and go, bicycle style brakes.
Yep.
So it's incredibly familiar. You can go from kind of zero to hero very, very quickly. Again, they're sort of super lightweight, relatively low saddle height, so they're good for small people, tall people. Mm-hmm. So it was really just trying to make biking a bit more inclusive than it is currently.
That's it. So the first bike, relatively low power, low speed, 45 miles an hour top speed?
Yeah, 45 right? miles per hour, 80 miles with two batteries, or you can have one battery, 40 miles. You're able to either use a single battery and use the what looks like the fuel tank for mm-hmm. 10 litres of storage, so you can put your shopping, change of clothes, whatever it might be in there, or you plug the second battery in there and then they run in parallel.
Brilliant.
And you can decide, you can sort of make that decision on a weekly basis. So you might go, right, for this trip I just want 40 miles, 10 miles.
Of course.
I'm going to use that for my shopping. All right, today I'm doing a slightly longer trip. I'm going to plug the second battery in.
Yeah.
And there's a clever bit of software that we've developed, which basically will basically run one battery down until they're both at the same rate and then discharge them together.
Got it.
So that they don't sort of discharge each other and damage each other.
Yeah. I love it. I love the idea. It's a while now since I've lived and worked in central London. For a good stint of time, I was commuting from my home near Wimbledon to an office in Notting Hill. And some days I'd get the tube, other days, because I'm a maniac, I'd drive my car. And I think back now, I think, God, if there was an option then to have something where I could just hop on as a bike or a scooter, electric power back and forth because of the removable batteries. I like the idea of perhaps having a charging pad at the office and the charging pad at home. That way, you know, you're never going to get caught out. You can have one in each place. It just seems to make so much sense. And I'm sure that for the majority of people that are buying them that live in cities like, you know, big cities like London, Birmingham, Manchester, Edinburgh, it kind of makes perfect sense. It cancels out, as you say, for all those other reasons, including the cost of getting the tube or jumping on public transport or driving your own car if you're a maniac like me. It's very difficult to try and work out why you wouldn't want to do this.
No, definitely. And just on the charging point, it's interesting because there's so much conversation about range anxiety. And I think most people tend to equate that with the range that a vehicle can do.
Yeah.
And actually, I would argue that range anxiety is more about charging than it is about the range. Because, look, for example, I mean, it used to be the case that mobiles had about 5 days worth of battery.
That's right, yeah.
Do you remember remember the glory days?
Good old Nokia.
Good old Nokia. And people were furious when suddenly your phone could only do 2 days.
Yeah.
And then they were furious when, an iPhone can probably manage two-thirds of a day now.
That's right, yeah.
But actually, people aren't furious. And the reason is that it's people's charging habits that have changed. You now have a charger at home, you have a charger in the office, and you don't think twice about it. You just plug it in.
That's it, yeah.
And so what's changed is charging habits. And similarly, if you can just take the battery out and you can charge it at a standard socket, and you could theoretically do that in your office or a cafe or whatever, you don't need to be concerned about range in the same way that you would do if you were using that vehicle for long motorway stretches and, sure, you know, your delivery van and you need to do 500 miles in a day.
Yeah.
So I can't stress enough how that removable battery technology is the key to unlocking this space for now with sort of energy density as it is. But as for, you know, biking more broadly, as I said to you, I first justified getting a bike to myself because I was working Slough and I was cycling to Paddington, train from Paddington to Slough, company shuttle bus to the office. Something would go wrong, you know, every week in that journey. Obviously, a train would you know, be delayed. And I worked it out. Of course, I just wanted a motorbike, but this is how I rationalised it to myself.
Yeah.
I was like, look, if I cut down my commute by half an hour, then I save 26 days a year in commuting time.
Wow.
And that, you know, so I sort of knew that when I bought the bike. But what I didn't realise is that every day the alarm would go off, and instead of being miserable, I'd be excited, like, every day to ride the bike because it is so much fun.
Yeah.
And it's so satisfying, not zooming 70 miles per hour illegally through a city, but just passing all the traffic, as you say, the nutters like yourself that are sitting in a car in zone one. I mean, it's just, and you're reliably getting to this is true of bicycles as well, to some extent. It's obviously faster on a bike, but the minute you get used to the idea that you can know for certain that you're going to be in the office 20 minutes after you set off, it's a game changer.
Absolutely.
And I think, public transport is struggling. You know, it's a lot more busy than it used to be. And certainly through COVID, everyone kind of decided, actually, I don't want to be pressed up against somebody else, necessarily. So I think, that was a huge boost to the e-bike market. And, there was a massive boom in electric motorcycles and scooters as well during that period, because people kind of went, actually, I'd rather have my own form of transport.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean a car, because it's a city.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely. So then talk to me about the next chapter. So that first one's clearly worked. The buyers have come in there, many thousands. They've bought them, loved them, used them. And then a lot of people, like me, then saw the design and went, God, that's a cool-looking bike. I have to get myself on one of those. I want to try it out. And then saw, top speed, 45 miles an hour. Probably not going to work immediately for me. I live just out on the border of the Cotswolds, so therefore every road around me is 60 miles an hour. So it's thinking, that's a bit daunting to suddenly jump on something like that. And of course, if I want to go and see my family in London or ride around, then perhaps it's going to be a little bit more difficult. However, then comes along the announcement that there's a new bike that does 70 miles an hour and also still has an incredible range of 80 miles, where you can remove the battery and plug it into a pad and then carry on. So the reaction to that must have been amazing. And what was it that spurred that on? Was that always the plan, to have a higher power bike? Or was that something that you thought, okay, we need to probably start thinking about how we make this a bit quicker?
No, it was definitely always the plan, and to some extent you're dealing with energy density, and you're looking at, you know, the benefit that comes from battery cells improving and what you can, you know, feasibly achieve with bigger motors and bigger battery packs, etc., while still making something you can take out and carry.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that was really solidified for us was, you know, there are various routes that we could have gone in terms of the design, you know, bench. There's other things that we could have introduced, but the message loud and clear from prospective customers was, love the design of the RM1,
yeah,
just want it to go a kind of highway capable speed, basically.
Absolutely.
You know, as you were just saying, I live on the outskirts of a city, or I have an A road that I need to be on for a short period of my commute, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So sort of love what you're doing, but please get back in touch with me when you're making something that just enables me to sort of go that step further, or opens up the number of roads that I can use.
That's it.
And I think also, you know, over and above that, by limited, you know, there are plenty of our customers who go, why would I ever need to go 70 miles per hour? I'm just using this bike for riding around town. You know, I live in Bristol, and you know, I've got my car for longer journeys, and I've got this for Bristol. But there are also plenty of people who go, no, I want to be able to go to Box Hill on the weekend, or I want to be able to do these other things. And so it's you're asking me to make a little bit more of a kind of discretionary purchase when I buy something that's capped at 45 miles per hour. So it was basically just answering that call. So the brief was, right, we want to try and make it as close as possible in looks to the RM1.
Yes.
So that single bobber seat, that's my favourite bit of the whole bike.
Yeah, it's lovely.
You know, all of that, but we want it to increase its capability. So double the power and increase the top speed to 70 miles per hour.
Perfect.
And what that just means now is that people who live outside of city centres and whose commutes might involve, you know, a few miles on a motorway or A road stretches, that they can now have access to zero emissions riding if they want.
That's it.
And yeah, that the reception to that bike has been really great.
Yeah, I can imagine. And for me, it's the answer, because my commute is the A46, which is
a
good 19 miles of dual carriageway.
And I think also, you know, people like you and me have been riding a little bit. You might be used to a little bit more power, and
so it's just, you know,
there is a difference between riding something that's more like a 125,
yes,
or something that's more like a 250. It's just a little bit more kind of, yeah, a little bit nippier if you're used to that kind of thing. It's still, to be clear, very much a small, you know, city orientated bike as far as we're concerned,
yes,
but it's just got that bit more capability.
Has the capability, absolutely. So at the time of recording this, we are a week or so outside of Christmas 2023. The bike itself, the new bike, the S, that's coming out for customers next year, isn't it?
So we've been taking orders, and they'll be built in the new year and delivered from March.
Fantastic. So not long to wait. That's really
no
exciting.
and I suppose we think about it in terms of the riding season. I mean, because these bikes are mainly used in urban spaces, that's less relevant, because it's flipping uncomfortable riding 2 hours on the motorway and 2 degrees. It's not so bad riding 5 miles in a city.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the riding season is a little bit less of a thing. But as you know, a lot of people will put a cover over their bike over the Christmas months, because it's
absolutely
a bit chilly.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I'm really excited to see the new bike. Even more excited to have a go. Hopefully, I'll with the lovely team at Potsky Media, who sorted out the current Maven bike for me, will be able to hook me up with a new one when it comes out. Because that'll be really exciting just to do exactly as I say, commuting back and forth to the office, and I think will be absolutely brilliant. So then, of course, the inevitable question that you know I'm going to ask is, what comes next then, and what is the idea of the vision? You know, we've mentioned things like touring bikes and sports bikes. Do you think that's ever going to be on the horizon, or have you decided that you know what you're focusing on, you know what works, and it's just a case of refining that?
It's a good question, because I think the first couple of things I'd say is that we don't want to be a niche British brand. We want to drive as much progress in terms of electric adoption around the world. So we are, you know, one of the big things we're now focused on is our international expansion. And so we do want to be one of the big players driving change in this sector, and to be renowned on the international stage. And I've always said, and I'll say it again, that we want to make bikes that cater, you know, for all use cases.
Sure.
I think we'll always focus we'll always be working with the technology that's available and obviously progressing it, but making, as I said, bikes that are truly, that there's a truly good use case for them versus their petrol counterparts. And we think the sweet spot right now is urban areas, removable batteries, and so we will not progress beyond that before the technology enables us to make really compelling bikes in those other spheres.
Yeah.
But I guess the interesting thing is, to some extent, the kind of sexy end of the sector is the performance end. Mm. You know, but it just really is worth reiterating that, you know, 80% of people live in urban environments.
Yeah.
Most people are making small journeys, and so it's important not to get too captivated by the kind of by that maybe slightly more glamorous sort of side of the market, but
romance.
It's actually but you know, before it's ready or when actually it's not the thing that's going to drive change. So I think we'll proudly remain in, I'm going to call it, the less sexy side of the performance market.
No, I disagree. I think there's a very, the product itself is so it's so exciting, it's so unusual. And I think if somebody had said to me even 2 or 3 years ago, imagine an electric motorcycle designed for commuting, I wouldn't have thought it would be anything as good looking as the product you've got.
Definitely. And to be clear, I'm perfectly big-headed when it comes to that. I think I'm delighted to say that the likes of MCN, I can't remember who the other was, but the two biggest motorcycle reviewers, they both said, we've never had more attention on any bike,
absolutely,
including petrol bikes, than on this bike. And I'm really proud. I think we've built something which is beautiful, and I like to think that there are lots of people who are just switching to electric because it's beautiful and they love it and they genuinely would choose it over any of its petrol counterparts. I think when I say less set, I'm just purely talking about the kind of performance specs.
Yeah.
Will you see a kind of hyper bike from us in the near future? The answer is probably no. But I think, will we continue to sort of drive progress in this field when it comes to bikes that are genuinely really compelling in terms of urban commuting and beyond? Then yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, slowly building up a lot more expertise in driving progress when it comes to motor technology and batteries and, you know, all of that kind of thing. I think you'll see some pretty exciting stuff from us
in
the future without giving it all away.
Yeah, no, that's really exciting. And I think you're right. We're in this fascinating time now where we are seeing the technology, the curve of advancement is just huge at the moment, isn't it? You know, battery technology, cell technology, motor technology, it's just growing at a rate that's just fantastic, which needs to happen. It needs to happen across the board for the big transition from internal combustion engines to EVs in the world of cars, in the world of trucks, in the world of vans, and of course in the world of motorcycles and for the more fun stuff as well. So yeah, exciting stuff. Really, really looking forward to seeing what those advancements do for the Maven product moving forward as well.
No, definitely. And I also, again, as someone who's grown up loving petrol cars and bikes, and I still drive a little Mazda MX-5, which I to this day say is one of the funnest cars you can possibly drive. And I love the gear change, and I love that, you know, that is a car, however affordable, which has been designed to be enjoyable and engaging to drive. But I do believe that electric will also sort of surprise and delight people in that sphere as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't that long ago that I was racing's the wrong word, but riding a live wire and the new Del Mar around the Malibu Canyons in LA. And it was such an exhilarating ride, and it was exhilarating in ways that are different from kind of petrol counterparts. And so I do believe that more and more people will view electric as as exhilarating and bringing something to the table also in terms of the ride and the experience.
Perfect. So watch this space, I guess, is what we're saying, isn't it?
Watch this space.
If people aren't following, then make sure you already are. I'll include all of the links through to Maving in the little bio. So wherever you're listening to this, if you scroll down, you'll be able to see all the links to the social feeds and the website if you want to learn more. And I love the fact you hinted there a little while ago at the affordability of these, and I need to be careful because it's, you know, this isn't an advert for Maving, but it's always worth pointing out when you can get a really, really good looking motorcycle that could potentially tickle the boxes of what you might need for less than 100 quid a month on a finance deal. That's pretty good, isn't it? I mean, I think I pay more than that for a phone, which is very upsetting.
Yeah, that's a good. I've not drawn that comparison. I fear my bill's close to that as well.
Yeah, it
is completely, and that is, we really cared about that. You know, I think it's all very well making electric vehicles, which are, I suppose, designed a sort of hypercars, whatever it might be, and are designed to kind of push the field forward, but they're just not attainable for most people. And you are still paying a bit of a green premium in terms of the purchase price, but genuinely with our bikes and with similar bikes that do sort of a relatively similar thing, you're the cost saving, particularly with petrol as it is right now, is tremendous. Absolutely. Over the life cycle of the bike. It really mattered to us that we were making an EV that was attainable, and made people feel that they could sort of choose to make that kind of conscientious purchase without breaking the bank.
Yeah.
And I'm again proud that we've done that whilst making it in the UK.
Yeah.
And the ambition is very much to bring, I mean, at the moment 65% of our components are made here, which is pretty unusual in the automotive world, but we want to get as many, you know, parts made here as well, and really champion the kind of British engineering piece.
Brilliant. I like the idea that perhaps 20 or 30 years from now, as we all do, as often, if you meet a petrolhead car person, motorcycle person in a pub or somewhere like Caffeine the Machine, you might say, oh, what was your first car? I like the idea that 20 years down it might be, what was your first EV? And a lot of people, I think a lot of people will say, oh, it was a Mavic. It was a little, you know,
that's run around. Dream.
Isn't that cool? Wouldn't that be cool? This has been great. Thank you so much, Seb. It's been fabulous learning about it. It's been fabulous to see your factory in its absolute infancy, warts and all, which makes it sound like the company's brand new. It's not, but this is the evolution, the fact that you've had to move to a stonkingly massive premises, which is currently under construction. You might have heard there, dear listener, throughout our recording, the sounds of racking going up and pallets being dragged around, but it's all part of the part of the story, which is really, really exciting. I look forward to coming back when it's all finished and having a proper look around.
Please do, and it won't be long as well. Come back in a month or two,
yeah.
And it'll be a very different space. But it's been an absolute pleasure, John.
Brilliant, thank you so much. And as for you, dear listener, as I say, if you want to learn more about the company, scroll down, have a look at the show notes below. You'll see all the descriptions, the links, and everything else there. As well as that, of course, I've got one of these bikes on test right now, and I am riding it over the winter months. Because, as I've alluded to, I'm an idiot. I'm a maniac. Why would I wait until the summer? No, let's do it in the winter. So I'll be writing a review of that, and you'll be able to see it on the website. That's driven.site, where you will also see, as I alluded to at the very beginning of this episode, the news that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, is coming to an end. This is our penultimate episode. Next week's episode will be our last ever. But if that's causing you all sorts of emotional distress, don't worry. Go and visit the website. Click the little banner that you'll see very easily, and everything is explained there. That's all I'll say. For now, I'll say thank you for listening. We will be back next week. And finally, thank you again, Seb. It's been great.
Thanks.
The Driven Chat podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end. The very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.